Good evening, everybody. I'm Gretchen Nikoloff with the League of Women Voters. The League wants to thank you all for coming, and we want to particularly thank the Delta County Republican Women for inviting us to moderate this event and for providing us with refreshments. And just to be as nonpartisan as possible, we also want to thank the Delta County Democrats for providing even more refreshments. We also are, I think I've told the audience this before, we are live streaming to KVNF's listening audience tonight. We want to thank KVNF for doing that. We think it's a wonderful opportunity for people who can't come out to hear what the candidates have to say. And KVNF will also be doing this on Thursday night from Montrose for the forum for the Montrose County Commissioners. So big thanks to KVNF and also for the wonderful sound system. At least we hope it'll be wonderful. And I wanted everybody to know there are ballot issue pamphlets in the back of the room on the literature table made available to you by the League. If you find it in your heart to leave us a contribution for one, that would be lovely. They do cost us money, but we're actually very happy if you will take one and read it. The Blue Book is a little intimidating this year. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan political organization, and our mission is to promote active and informed citizen participation in government, and that's what we're doing tonight. The League never supports or opposes candidates or political parties, but we do take positions on issues. So tonight, we are pleased to have Aaron Clay as our moderator, and I will turn it over to him, and he will explain how it's all going to work.
Thank you, Gretchen. Tonight is a candidates forum where it's a town hall style where you each get to ask a question, but we're going to filter the questions a little bit just to make sure that they're appropriate for this particular forum and that we don't ask the same question too many times. So if you have a question, you need to get a 3x5 card, write your question down, raise it up in the air, one of the ushers will pick it up from you, and then our jury over here will decide if it's an appropriate question. If they decide that it is an appropriate question, then they'll hand it to me, and then I'll ask the candidates, and they get a chance to answer. We'll start with a 4-minute opening by each of these candidates. They each get 2 minutes to answer a question, and if you ask a candidate a specific question, I'll ask that candidate to respond first, but the other candidate always gets a chance to respond to the same question. We have drawn lots. We have drawn out of the hat to see who gets to go first, and Robert won this particular round, so he will give his opening statement, but that means that Millie gets the closing statement because we'll go in the same order. So at the end of the forum, each of them will have a minute and a half to wrap it up for us. So that should take us about an hour, and then we'll take about a 5 or 10 minute break so we can reset the stage and have the county commissioners candidates come up, and we'll do the same thing in the second hour. I'm just not going to read the entire set of rules to you. I just expect everybody to be decent citizens. So first, let's have a round of applause for our candidates. And now I'm going to ask you to hold your applause for the rest of the next hour, and then we'll have another round of applause at the end. But please let the candidate speak. So we're now ready for an opening statement. That's a lawyer's term. By Mr. Shutt.
Hi, thank you very much. I also want to thank the League of Women Voters for hosting this wonderful event, and Gretchen, who's done a lot of the organization, too, for putting it together. I actually look in the audience, and I see some familiar faces. I've been on the road a bit over the last few months, and I've run into some of the familiar faces, and I'm glad to see them back here. But my name is Dr. Bob Shutt. And I live and work in Crested Butte, Colorado. I'm an orthopedic surgeon there. And what I plan to do is bring some experience from the communities to our legislature and represent a change from the status quo. And that's I think, is a good thing from where we are going and where we need to be. I'll tell you a little bit about my background, since some of you don't know me. I did go to the Air Force Academy years ago, and this institution is known for integrity, character, and leadership in its graduates, and that's what I really plan to bring to the legislature, is the traits that I had as a cadet at the Air Force Academy. I did have an opportunity to be a combat veteran, so I do have a lot of loyalty to our veterans. I was a decorated fighter pilot in Vietnam, flew F-4 Phantoms, and then I had a second chance to be on active duty, and that was during Gulf War I, where I was a combat surgeon in support of the 3rd Armored Division in their effort to retake Baghdad. So I've only been on active duty twice, but they were just for the wars. I am an experienced educator. I have to bring education as an important part, and I do support the education of our children. But my background was a little different. I was a medical school department chairman and a tenured professor. And in that job and in that capacity, I had the responsibility of running a department, administering a budget, trying to allocate resources the best way I could. I ended up having to teach residents, and I had to teach medical students, and I had to conduct a research as part of the department. And last of all, I was actively involved in patient care and running a level one trauma center. So that kind of experience is the kind of experience I'll bring to that area. And I grew up with education because my wife was an elementary school teacher, too, on top of that. The one area that I really bring is experience in healthcare, and we all know that healthcare is in a crisis right now. And I actually received my orthopedic surgical training at the University of Colorado. When elected, I will be the only physician in the House of Representatives. And tell me that isn't a big responsibility in today's environment with the way healthcare is going, rising premiums, affordable healthcare not working, and trying to provide care for all of the people of this community and the other communities within the state. So I think that I would really love the opportunity to be able to guide Colorado's healthcare policy during this difficult time and try to guide it in the right direction. One of the reasons I love being in the Western Slope, and I actually drove over here today, is I'm an outdoorsman, and I just love looking at the natural environment. I'm hiking, fishing, road biking, and I do these things. I work as a community volunteer in Crested Butte. I'm a musician, and I'm a Coloradoan. And one of the reasons I'm running for office is I want to effect a positive change in how Colorado's tax dollars are being spent. I know my opponent's on the budget committee, but I think there's better ways that can they be expanded, and I really would like to do that, and I have a strong vision that life for Coloradoans can be better. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, good evening. I also want to thank the League of Women Voters for sponsoring this forum tonight, and I want to thank all of you for coming and listening on the radio. I also want to say how much I appreciate my opponent's service to this country and his profession. And I think you saw us chatting up here tonight, so we're getting to know each other and kind of like each other. So I just want to say that. I have had the honor of serving in the legislature for the past 6 years. And in Colorado, we have term limits. I'm term limited if I'm elected one more time, and I'm hoping that I can be elected one more time, because I have grown really fond of the work at the Capitol and the work that I've been doing for you as your representative, and I'd like to continue, and I have the energy and passion and commitment to do that. As you heard, I am the chair of the Budget Committee, and in that role, I'm working really, really hard with my Republican colleagues on the Budget Committee. There are 3 Republicans and 3 Democrats. And together, we worked on a budget that did the best we possibly could to meet the needs of you and the people of Colorado. So working in a bipartisan way is something that I'm very proud of and something that I really enjoy doing in the legislature. I also had a 35-year career as a public educator, working as an elementary teacher, middle school teacher, and ended my career in education as superintendent of schools. So I'm well positioned to deal with challenges that our schools are facing. For you specifically in Delta County, I looked at my bill list, and I have in 6 years passed 60 bills, and that doesn't include the bills that I've passed as part of the budget committee. But I've been working really hard. I know that the schools are struggling with funding. It's very difficult in Delta County to fund the small schools like we have in Paonia and Hotchkiss and Cedar Ridge and Crawford. It's just more costly to fund smaller schools. So I've been working really hard. This past year I carried the school finance bill again and was able to tweak the size factor a little bit to give Delta County schools just a little boost. I've also supported the Ready Grant program, the Rural Jumpstart program. These are both programs that are benefiting the people in Delta County. I carried the bill to look at the feasibility of having one geographic rating for health insurance for the state. Unfortunately, the bill passed, but the insurance division commissioner didn't think it was a good idea. So we're back to the drawing board. I've been appointed to a task force commissioned by the lieutenant governor to look at real short and long-term solutions to affordable health care in the region. I've also supported the Creative Arts District that Paonia has taken advantage of and is enjoying. I've supported the cottage foods industry because I think here it's the perfect place to have these incredible farms and organic produce, and people are just eating it up, literally. All over the farmers markets, all over the district in Crested Butte and Aspen, they're selling the products that are grown right here, and I'm doing everything I can to support that. As the chair of the budget committee, as I mentioned, we're working really hard in a bipartisan way to balance the budget with all of the constraints and challenges we have in Colorado. I've been working really hard, as I said, to reduce the high cost of individual health insurance. Another top priority for me is seeking equity and adequacy in the way we fund our schools so that we have better outcomes for all of our children. Also working hard to support a strong economy throughout the district. In Delta County, the economy hasn't quite rebounded as quickly as it has in other parts of the district, and I have some specific ideas about that. And also working really hard to protect our beautiful environment. I'm a member of the Wildfire Matters Interim Committee, so I'm working with ways to mitigate wildfires, but also to be ready to respond in case we need to in Colorado. I hope to have your support so that I can finish out my last 2 years. I look very much forward to working with you and hope to have your vote. Thank you.
Thank you. For those of you listening in KVNF land, we just finished the opening remarks with both candidates of House District 61. We're now going to go back and forth between the candidates to answer some questions. And since Bob got to go first in the opening statement, Millie gets to go first with the first question, 2 minutes. And the question is, how can our state better address our infrastructure problems, roads, bridges, and other public facilities? How can our state better address our infrastructure problems? Millie.
Thank you. This is a big challenge. It's what I have been doing for the last 2 years on the budget committee. The challenge is really how do we take the resources that we have in a state that has Tabor, which means that if we're going to increase any revenue into our budget, the people of Colorado have to vote for that tax increase. So we're in a situation where we're very close to hitting the Tabor limit in our budgeting, which means that if we go over that limit, we refund to each of you some of your taxes that you've invested in the state level. At the same time, we have a huge need to invest in our infrastructure, in our roads, our transportation, our education system, and mental health services. So how do we do it? Well, those of you that do budgeting know, or you try to manage your own checkbook, I mean, we have the budget as a pie. It's not limitless. It's a pie. And if we're going to increase funding in any other area, we have to take it from something existing now in our budget. So that's where it's really hard to do those kinds of trade-offs. If we want to fund more in education, then we have to take it from some other part. What we have been doing is taking it out of higher education, which at the end result means that students who are attending our universities are paying more and is coming out of your pocket if you have children going to college. So there's a short-term solution that I supported this past year that didn't make it through the Republican-led Senate, and that was to consider a fee that we collect into the budget, the hospital provider fee, and our own Republican Attorney General ruled that it was legitimate for the legislature to do this, to keep this revenue because it really wasn't a tax increase and was not subject to the Tabor amendment to our Constitution. So I'm hoping as we pick up the pieces again next session, we can put that revenue back on the table, invest that money into the critical infrastructure needs that this state has. Thank you.
Bob, same question of you. 2 minutes. How can our state better address our infrastructure problems?
Well, it goes back to the Budget Committee. They had to steal money from somewhere when they spent so much money on social programs last year. They overspent the budget $350 million with Medicaid expansion and some social welfare programs. And we, like other states in the country, have to have a balanced budget. My opponent will tell you how she balanced the budget, but it's the law she has to balance the budget. There's no mystery, but when you balance the budget and you put money in programs such as Medicaid expansion and things like that that weren't planned, then it has to come out of K-12 education and transportation, which are equally important. In fact, I met with some of the judges last week, and they were complaining that even the criminal system got hit, and they were discouraged about it. So I think it's you know, we as individuals and citizens have to protect our budget and respect our taxpayers. And that's one of the things I disagree with or my opponent, is that we spend money that we have and only money we have, and instead of spending money and then finding ways to pay for it, which means raising taxes for the most part, and we can't do it based on Tabor. So, yes, I think it's a matter of, as legislature, as representative of your district, realizing, and driving over here today, I realize it very well, how that we may need to put money back into some of the infrastructure and the roads, and we'll just have to figure out ways to do it within the constraints that the legislature currently has on us. But again, we need to spend money that we have available to us, and the chicanery of the hospital provider fee is just another way of getting around the budget and coming up with extra money for use outside of our budget. Thanks.
Thank you. Bob, you're still up.
Oh, good.
This next question is, 2 minutes, do you see any long-term solutions to the problems in funding education? Do you see any long-term solutions to the problems in funding education?
Well, as you are aware of, education is one of my priorities as well as my opponent's priorities. And the way education is funded is primarily through the general fund and then through local referendums. And the money provided for education is then put in the hands of the school boards and school superintendents. So the best way to use the funds that we have allocated to us are making the money available locally so the local people can decide themselves on what, I mean, for example, if you were a principal or superintendent, you needed another art teacher or you needed another music teacher, you know that better than a person at a higher level, and you've got access to the funds to make those things happen. You can't spend your education dollars on more and more administration. And the one common thing to providing a better student is the teacher. So whatever we can do to improve the quality of the teacher is what the product of our student is that comes out of the environment of the school systems. There are systems. There's a program called BEST. It's building, it's an acronym, BEST, building something for school. I'm blanking on it right now. But it's where some of the money placed into the physical structures, and that's a very helpful thing. But the biggest cost in education is really in the salaries and the operating cost of the school district. And those are really left as much possible to the people locally. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Millie, same question. 2 minutes.
Thank you. I love this question. I wish I had it in an hour, but in 2 minutes. Okay. So over the last couple decades, what's happened is more pressure has been put on the state budget to fund our public schools. It used to be that two-thirds of the funding happened at the local level, and the state budget filled in the other third. Now it's flip-flopped. And there's a variety of reasons about why that's happened. So now the burden to fund public education is about two-thirds on the state budget. And so 40% of our general fund budget goes to funding our schools. So that's why when we talk about how to get more money into our schools, it's difficult using our general fund because we use it for so many other critical purposes in the state budget. So what some local districts have done is they've gone to their local tax base and asked for mill levy overrides. And so what's happened is we have a lot of school districts that have a lot more money per pupil because their voters have approved it, but not here in Delta County. So what's happened is it's increased the inequity in the amount of funding that we have per student, and I think that's wrong. I support the communities that are doing that, and I understand why they're doing it, but I think it's wrong. And so what I think the long-term solution is, and we've tried several on the ballot. There's been Proposition 103. There was Amendment 66. They failed miserably. There was talk about getting a measure on the ballot this year to debruce some of the revenue that we receive at the state budget to invest in our schools. That didn't make the ballot. So what's the long-term solution? I have it. I'm working with a Republican colleague of mine on the budget committee to start a conversation. You know how the governor put in place the water plan, getting input all around the state through all the water basins about what to do about Colorado's water needs. We envision a very similar plan where we engage all the people of Colorado in what do we want for our kids and then how are we going to pay for it. And we believe that by energizing these conversations in our communities, we can raise awareness about what's really working well for our students and what we want to see for them moving forward and how we're going to pay for it. So I'm looking forward to that conversation with you.
Okay, thank you. Millie's first this time. Next question is, 2 minutes. What is your view on Amendment 71, which would make it more difficult to amend the Colorado Constitution? What is your view on Amendment 71, which would make it more difficult to amend the Colorado Constitution?
I'm a supporter of Amendment 71. I signed on as a supporter early on in the process. Over the years, I mean, you can look at how many amendments we have to our Colorado Constitution. And I've got a colleague of mine who holds up the national constitution and then holds up Colorado's constitution. It's like this thick versus this thick. And the problem to me is that we have the situation where if an entity wants to get a measure on the ballot, all they have to do is stand somewhere in the front range and pay somebody to collect signatures. And we never have a chance to weigh in. We on the Western Slope don't have the votes. And we're never even asked about getting a measure on the ballot. So what I really like about raising the bar is that it requires an equal amount of signatures to get a measure on the ballot from all of the Senate districts in the state. And I think that gives all of us more of a say and more buy-in into measures that are presented to the voters. And I know there are different opinions on this issue. Some people say that if you make it harder, it's going to cost more to get ballot measures passed. But I think it's a good thing.
Okay. Bob, same question. What is your view on Amendment 71, which would make it more difficult to amend the Colorado Constitution?
Well, I too am a supporter of having this amendment pass. I think it's far too easy to get ballot issues on and then only take 50 or 51% of the voting public to permanently embed something in the Constitution. In fact, that's really one of my concerns. I look at affordable health care, which was put on, then 4 years later it's not working, and there's ways to get rid of it. But if you get Amendment 69 on, it gets embedded in the Constitution, and it's stuck there. It's just hard to get it reversed. My wife and I actually were at a concert in Denver, and they pay these people to get signatures, and I asked the guy who was coming to us about the issue, and he had no idea what he was even getting signatures for. He's being paid by a group of people just to get signatures to get something on the ballot. So if you have money, you can get anything on the ballot to amend the Constitution. My one reservation is slightly different than Representative Hamner's, is I'm concerned about the way they did it, that one outline Senate district can hold the whole process hostage. So I'm still not decided about that because I think that if the majority of the people really want the amendment, it shouldn't be held hostage by one Senate district. Although, in general, I think it's very important. It's just far too easy to get things embedded in our Constitution. And if you look this year at all these articles that are out there. These are not just referendums for the people or for a bill. They are all amendments to the Constitution, and that's not where these things belong.
Thank you. Bob, your turn. What is your position about Amendment 69, which is the statewide health care system amendment?
Sure. Well, I will tell you right off the top that I am opposed to it, and I maybe even just applied a little bit to that a minute ago. And essentially, there are so many things, and I actually have to say I'm my opponent is opposed to it too. We've had a previous debate, and I think that's a good thing. The problem with Amendment 69 is it's $25 billion in taxes that get added to our state constitution, to our state budget. It's not administered by the legislature. It's administered through an appointed panel, and it's going to be devastating to the small businesses. That type of additional tax is not going to be a job creator. It's going to be a job eliminator. Because what will happen is you'll find most of the people, and particularly in this Delta County that run small business, will find off they'll have to lay off about a third of their people just to keep their overhead even. You'll find people moving to the state just because they have health care problems and they can get their residency required, and next thing you know, they're covered in the state. At the same time, you'll see people like physicians moving out. You'll have difficulty in recruiting physicians to the state. If this were not a single state issue, then I could understand it. But if it's only one state doing it, it's a problem. I do think it's raised an awareness of our health care crisis, and that's good. I think that all people need to have access to health care. I think that's good. I think pre-existing conditions need to not be part of our system so people can maintain health care insurance, and that's good. But this is just unjust and not the right vehicle to have it happen.
Thank you. Millie, same question. 2 minutes. What is your position about Amendment 69, the statewide health care system proposal?
Yes, and thank you. And on these amendments and these initiatives that are on the ballot, I just want to make it clear that I personally am not campaigning for or against any of them. I think that they are up for they're up for the vote of the people of Colorado for you all to decide. But my opinion of Amendment 69 is I personally am voting no. I understand why the proponents put it on the ballot. One of my colleagues in the Senate is Irene Aguilar is instrumental in putting it on the ballot. And it's a response to the fact that there are a lot of questions about who's making the money in this health industry. And are there reasonable profits? And would Colorado be in a better position to just take it on all ourselves? To me, that seems like a very huge thing to take on at the state level. And I just worry a lot about the devil being in the details about how that would actually really work. Instead, what I really want to work on is figuring out how, and the other thing Amendment 69 doesn't do is it doesn't do anything to address the costs of care, which is driving up the insurance rates. So what I'd like to see us really focus on is what can we do to reduce the cost of care? And that's what I'm working on right now with this task force that I mentioned with Lieutenant Governor. And I think that's where we need to focus our energy. Again, I do commend the efforts of those who are working so hard to fix this problem in Colorado, but I just don't think it's the right solution.
All right. Thank you. Millie, you're up. Next question is the statement first and then the question. The statement is, the revenues the state collects from oil, gas, and mining have always been a significant part of the state budget and also Delta County's budget. Everyone knows that these revenues are declining. The question is, would you support a tax on wind or solar facilities that are on public lands to offset the decline in fossil fuel taxes and royalties? Would you support a tax on wind or solar facilities on public lands to offset the decline in fossil fuel taxes and royalties?
Wow, that's the first time I've ever been asked that question, so I don't think I have a very good answer for it. I'm not sure if the tax is the right solution. I do believe that we need to focus on economic development here in Delta County. I'm really concerned about, with the decline in the coal industry, what happens when people are out of jobs and The resultant impact to our schools means we have fewer students and fewer funding. And, you know, I want to do everything I can to protect the community from spiraling downward. And I think that there are new industries, our solar industry right here in Paonia, Solar Energy International, is a wave of the future. The farming, the organic farming that's going on here in the county, businesses that are relocating, some of the programs that we funded at the state level through the Ready Grant Program and rural economic development, I think if given enough time and enough resources, are ways that we can invest in the community and help move Delta County forward.
Okay. Bob, same question.
Yeah, that's an interesting question because I drive here from Crested Butte and I past these coal mines in Somerset, and I used to see trains going through them. It's actually been a demise of coal. And I'm not saying coal is what the future is, but certainly its demise has been driven economically. And the cost of energy have been steadily increasing since that time. And much of it, instead of taxing, which is the question that you're bringing up, the Democrats have provided subsidies to those industries of wind and solar so that coal couldn't even be able to compete economically or fairly. So, you know, I, as everybody else does, want clean, efficient, and affordable electricity. The transition to this renewable energy sources of wind and solar is important, and right now it seems the best alternative for clean, environmental sensitive energy. But according to the Wall Street Journal, which I agree with, the Democrats have a strategy when they want to destroy an energy. First, they pick a politically vulnerable target, which turned out to be coal. Then they pile on new regulatory cost. And the next thing they know is they shut the industry down. And the next thing they ask the taxpayers to bail out the system that was left without them. And that's what you're asking to do by taxing the solar and wind. So my opponent did put the nail in the coffin in coal in this region. She voted for and supported Senate Bill 252, which that really was the final nail in the coffin for shutting down the coal mines in this area. I'm not saying coal is a long-term solution, but I am really afraid that the progressive agenda that we have will next attack natural gas, which is the next vulnerable target that we see out there. And right now, the natural gas is keeping our electricity affordable. We want affordable, clean electricity and reasonably priced.
Nope. Thank you. Next question is for Bob. Not specifically, just because you're first. We have a mental health crisis. The impact is falling heavily on rural communities such as Delta County. What do you feel can be done to treat and assist these populations?
The big crisis really comes in the fact that the people go to emergency rooms. They need to be admitted. They have no long-term funding to keep mental health patients. And then it's even compounded because then they try to transfer them to the state hospital in Pueblo, and they're at their limits too. So it is a mental health crisis, and that has to be set up as a priority through the state legislature and for some concerns. But again, it takes funding, it takes discussion, and it falls in the medical category that you have for physicians, and we're having trouble affording medical care, and then the mental health crisis is even worse. Actually, again, last week when I was talking to the District 6 judges in Montrose, they had all the judges together, and they were discussing their problems and what they needed addressed in the next legislature because it hasn't been handled well in the past. And right at the top of the list is what do they do with the mental health patients that come in to the judicial system, and how do they find a place that gives them quality care and particularly the medicines. They really needed access to the medicines they needed, and they needed access to people to prescribe the medicines they needed. So you're absolutely right. It's critical, and it's something that needs to be addressed and looked at very carefully. It takes funding at the state level and takes local communities committed to solving the problems. But just by popping them into the hospital ERs keeping them for 72 hours on hold is not the answer. They need to be transitioned back into the community in appropriate manners.
Thank you. Millie, we have a mental health crisis. The impact is falling heavily on rural communities. What do you feel can be done to treat and assist these populations?
I agree that it is a crisis. I was visiting recently with some of my superintendent of schools friends, and we have the Safe to Tell hotline. And the superintendents were telling me about how the calls into those hotlines has increased with students saying that they were either considering suicide or they had friends who they knew at school who were considering suicide. I'm like, what on earth is going on? So I think this is really a very serious problem. I think that a lot of mental health services can start right in our schools with, great education and support from collaborative efforts with the community. That's where I've seen it be most successful. School-based health centers where there also is mental health, where there are mental health services available with a community collaboration between public and private partnerships, I think is a really strong model moving into the future. At the legislative level, again, it does take funding. So what I'm always listening for is, what communities need. I have found every community has resources and they have ideas. And as your representative, I'd like to know, what it is specifically that you think we need more of. And I'm always willing to listen and problem solve and help us figure out a path forward. A lot of times, the earlier we can intervene with a child's issues, the better. So strong early childhood programs and preschool programs, I think, are definitely a part of the solution. But in the legislature, we passed the Rural Health Preceptor Program, which puts in place some funding for rural programs. Also, I've always supported the Rural Practitioner Program, where we incentivize practitioners to do their understudy work, not using the right words with my physician partner here, but to encourage people to begin their practices and encourage that in our rural parts of Colorado.
Okay. Next question for both of you, starting with Millie. How do you see the management of federal and state public lands on the Western Slope? How can the state legislature encourage long-term economic benefits from public lands for Delta County communities?
Well, I think that the answer is not in having the state take over the public lands. I don't think that's a good answer to the problem. I think that we need to keep working with our congressional delegation to get more funding for our public lands. Again, I mentioned that I serve on the Wildfire Committee, and I know that we have public lands that are vastly in need of mitigation efforts. It's been a real challenge. I'll hear from constituents that have always gone hunting on a certain road, and all of a sudden the road is closed. So with no public input, I understand the frustration, and I think that we definitely need to be doing a better job. But again, I think that urging Congress, one of the things we have done on the Wildfire Committee is sent letters to Congress urging better management, urging a dedicated funding source for wildfires rather than using money that perhaps wasn't spent in another area. And I do think that we can do a much better job of advocating for our federal lands, but I don't think that the state is in the position to assume those responsibilities without considerable resources put back into the state to do so.
Okay. Bob, same question.
Sure. Well, we all are stewards of our natural resources and lands, and no one enjoys being outdoors more than I do, and we certainly need to preserve them for our children, grandchildren, and the like. Common sense resource management is, I just heard on the news that they're raising hunting and fishing licenses. Well, the state seems to have control of the wildlife, the games, the hunting, and that their enterprise, not tax system, allows them to maintain a viable state wildlife management program. But we have 70% of our lands just being federal lands, and the state has no ability to really police those. If you had a wildfire, can you imagine not depending on the federal resources to come in and fight it? We as a state don't. So We're absolutely right, but we need to protect all those natural federal lands through BLM and the other areas so that we continue to have access, we continue to hike, we continue to enjoy them. And the lands that the federal government has actually gotten intensively involved through their National Park Service and other organizations, they're doing a pretty good job managing them. And there's just no way at the state level we can do that. So I think that we have to partnership with the state government, continue enjoying our hiking and fishing and outdoors activities. And the most important thing we need to do is make sure we oppose any kind of commercial exploitation of these lands. And if we can do everything to keep the lands as pristine as we have them through some joint partnerships with the state and federal government, then we're in our best shape we can be in for now.
Thank you. Next question for Bob first. Do you support the North Fork alternative for the Bureau of Land Management's Range Management Plan? Do you support the North Fork alternative for the BLM Range Management Plan?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not really prepared that I could speak on that very well.
Okay.
I need to have more details and be able to research that topic more.
Okay. Millie, would you like to answer the question? Do you support the North Fork alternative for the BLM's Range Management Plan?
Well, unlike my opponent, I have not seen the plan fully, so I would need to really review that. But knowing my constituents in the North Fork, I have an idea of what it might include. And I think the interest here is that there are some places where people are worried about oil and gas development, and they're worried about what it means to their water. They worry about what it means to their crops and their orchards and their ranches if all of a sudden we have oil and gas activity. And So my hunch would be that there are some alternatives that take into account some places where it might not be appropriate to have oil and gas development. But again, I would need to do a little more research on exactly what the components of the plan are. But I'm very sympathetic to the interests of the people in the North Fork.
Okay. I have a specific question for Millie first. Millie, did you vote to suppress my Second Amendment rights?
Me? No, of course I didn't do that. I think we're talking about the gun safety legislation from a couple sessions ago, and I supported that legislation because I believe that we need to do everything possible to protect the citizens of Colorado. But I did nothing to vote. I absolutely believe in the Second Amendment rights, and I know that that's very important to the constituents here today.
Bob, I'm not going to ask you the same question because you haven't voted on that, but why don't you explain your position about the Second Amendment?
Sure. There was another, also on the magazine, clip size and some other things. My opponent has a history for her 6 years of just voting exactly what the Democratic caucus tells her to vote on, which included two bills that did tend to go against the Second Amendment. But as I travel through Colorado, that's one of the first questions that a lot of people have because they're hunters, they want to protect themselves. And the Second Amendment reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And this was ratified December 17, 1791. I see no reason to change that. And that's where we need to be. Americans have the right to own firearms, and that's not going to change, and I'm a gun owner. I don't hunt, but I am a supporter of the Second Amendment. And I understand that all of a sudden everybody wants to talk about it, including our presidential candidates, when a criminal or deranged person permits a gun crime. And it's not necessarily the gun that's causing the crime, it's the criminal or deranged person that's causing the crime. And so it's not due to the gun ownership. I believe that the Second Amendment, as written, strongly creates an individual right to possess and use guns for the purpose of both hunting and self-defense. I'm 100% behind the Second Amendment. I see no reason to change it in any way.
All right. Since that was a letter specifically to Millie, we're going to go back to the alternating system. So this is for Millie this time. Please explain successes or projects that demonstrate how you work across the aisle to move the state forward.
Thank you. As I said in my opening comments, I pride myself in my ability to work across the aisle. Of the 60 bills that I mentioned that I carried in my 6 years that aren't the Budget Committee bills, two-thirds of them are either had a bipartisan co-sponsor or had a Republican sponsor in the Senate. And one thing I've learned through the years is that it's much easier to get bills passed if they're bipartisan because there's less criticism. We work well together. Some of the examples of bills that I've carried in a bipartisan way are the cottage foods bill I carried with Representative Willett. Let's see, the I-70 fire suppression system in the tunnels I carried with Senator Scott. Right now, I've probably carried more bills with Representative Rankin from Garfield County, who's a Republican, than I've carried with any of my own colleagues. He and I are both working right now on this future vision that I talked about earlier about how to finance our schools and get better buy-in from the people of Colorado on what the future of education is. So it is really important to me to work in a bipartisan way and to get things done. It's what I've learned to do. To build relationships and to work well with others, I think it's what you want. It's what you expect. When you call me and you have an issue with CDOT or have trouble getting your teacher's license, I'm here to problem solve and figure things out. And one of the best ways to do that is in a bipartisan way.
Thank you. Bob, same question, although it's a little bit different.
Sure. Well, obviously our system is broken and there's too much friction. And people, when I was younger, used to get elected to the legislature just to follow their own beliefs and do what's right. And I remember reading a book about, you know, Mr. Lincoln goes to Congress and so forth. But the problem is when you have a majority of Democrats in the House and they vote as a block, then you can say it's bipartisan. But and you know, the governor's had such an easy job this year because the only legislation that ever goes in front of his desk to sign is those that's already been through the House through the majority party. And right now, I think the House has two seats more than the Republicans, Democrats to Republicans. And you can talk about bipartisan bills passed, but what happens is the total control of the House has been an in-block voting by the Democrats themselves. And you can see this carried forward in the gun restriction laws that we just discussed. You can see it carried forward in last week we were in Summit, and there were several issues that the Board of Realtors wanted to get in front to improve affordable housing and some things that would work well for their community. But the trial lawyers, in their pay-to-play way, forced the Democrats to block those bills from going forward or to kill them on the floor. So it's a very interesting predicament, and that's why I need to be there to balance out the House.
Okay, Bob, you're still up.
Well, good.
Next question. 2 minutes. The Affordable Care Act has drastically increased the number of people who rely on Medicaid. However, Medicaid pays a small percentage to medical providers like doctors and hospitals. How can this be fixed?
Well, you have to go back to the health care system as a whole. The Affordable Care Act correctly is not working, and the reason the Colorado Medicaid has been so high is that the expansion has been the way they've been trying to bail out the Affordable Care Act, and that again is the extra $350 million there that came out of the general fund and headed that direction this year. But it's draining the limited resources that we have in our state budget that need to go to the other things. The worst part about it is I don't know if many of you are aware how this exchange was set up, but Colorado was one of the few states, not few, but one of the states that voted to set up an exchange where commercial carriers would come in and Aetna, Anthem, Cigna, and United Healthcare, and they're all withdrawing because they lost money in the exchange, leaving very limited people in exchange, and they can charge whatever they want. So people apply for affordable health care, they go through the exchange, and then if they qualify, then they can get some federal subsidy and health insurance. But if they don't, and they're just above the poverty level, they're screwed. I mean, they get high health care premiums, high deductibles, and they have no other alternative. And the state has come in with an expansion of Medicaid, which really doesn't have any budget allowance for it. And that's what's really hurt our budget from now. So the healthcare exchange will be raising premiums, insurance companies are pulling out, and propping up healthcare with this Medicaid funding is really not the solution. We need to, again, try to figure out ways to lower the premiums on the western slope through, I think, interstate regulation, instead of releasing, get rid of the boundaries of states for insurance companies. And currently, competition-based markets seem to be the best way to drive premiums down.
Thank you. Millie, same question. The Affordable Care Act has drastically increased the number of people who rely on Medicaid. However, Medicaid pays a small percentage to medical providers like doctors and hospitals. How can this be fixed?
Well, first of all, I'm really pleased that people who've been underserved or not served at all are getting service. And when we look at the group of people who are part of the expansion population, they're the elderly and they're the disabled. And the truth of the matter is we're all getting older. Coloradans are getting older. And as we get older, we need more services, and people are relying on Medicaid and are getting the services that they need, sometimes for the first time. One of the ways that I think that we can start to look at cutting some of those costs and keeping that better contained is looking at those populations, and are there more ways that we can save money by keeping people in their homes rather than having them in nursing homes. So I've always supported increasing the provider rate, which provides more funding for people to deliver services to people in their home. That's where they want to be. It's less costly than investing in putting people in nursing homes and having those kinds of services. So I continually am working, trying to figure out how we can better serve this population, perhaps in a more economical way. But, you know, if we're looking at cutting Medicaid funding, I ask, well, who should be cut? Because I see a population of people that desperately need these services.
Okay. Next question. Amelia, you would start. Do you support hydraulic fracturing and its expansion as a future energy source?
You know, as a member of the Budget Committee and in other parts of House District 61, we see the economy booming. Tourism in Pitkin County and Summit County, and Gunnison County is really booming. And when we received our last financial forecast as a budget committee in September, there was such wide variance in the predictability of Colorado's budget that the economists that we were listening to almost used the word recession. And when we dig into the details, it really has to do with the oil and gas industry. And because the oil and gas industry is sort of stalling right now, or is not as strong as it once was, it's having a negative impact on the entire economy of Colorado. So I say that because I do support the industry. I do also support fracking. But I think that when we make decisions about where these events happen, we have to be very smart. Personally, I don't believe the Thompson Divide, for example, is a place where we want to have oil and gas development and fracking. There are probably some places in the North Fork where we don't want to see that activity. So I think the hard part is figuring out how to work with our communities and making smart decisions. How do we support the industry but also assure the people of Colorado that we're making smart choices and that are in their best interests?
Thank you. Bob, same question. Do you support hydraulic fracturing and its expansion as a future energy source?
We have to right now with the war on coal that's been raised. Believe it or not, 65% of the electricity that we have in Colorado comes from coal. And actually what's the most interesting part about that is most of the coal that's used for electricity comes from Wyoming and the Powder Basin and not from Colorado itself. And I think people want electricity. And as long as they want electricity, we're going to need an energy source. And if, you know, I know the coal mines are shut down so much, but our next cleanest alternative is natural gas. And we have a tremendous reservoir of natural gas in the western part of the state, in Delta and in out by Grand Junction is Piance Basin. And that area is a large supply of energy for us. One has to realize that natural gas is a fossil fuel too. So it does not, it's cleaner probably than coal, but it still has an imprint. And I hear so much about global warming and climate change. And, you know, I know some of the science behind it says it's real. But at the same time, we want clean and affordable energy. And if you want clean and affordable energy, you've got to support fracking and natural gas over at least the next decade. Maybe long-term, we'll have solar and wind replacing these. But until then, it would be a mistake to be against the natural gas industry.
Thank you, Bob. We've run out of time for questions. That means it's time for a 1.5-minute wrap-up by each of you. Since Bob got to go first in the opening, he gets to go first in the closing. That gives Millie the final word. So, Bob, you have a minute and a half.
Thanks. Well, thank you for letting me be here. What you need to know is that I'm not a traditional candidate. I want a change in the House of the way things are done, and I want to bring the values of the citizens to it. As part of my time in the House, I want to make sure we protect our budget and we respect our taxpayers. I don't want to be raising taxes at all, and we should be able to spend the money we have and do it in a very efficient way to reflect what we need to do. What we didn't get to talk about much today, which I think is important, is promoting small businesses and small business prosperity, because the best way to create jobs, when I drive through here, it looks like you could use a stronger economy for jobs, is to make sure the small businesses are successful, and we need to reduce barriers for the job creators. As you know, I want to protect our Second Amendment rights. I want to protect the public lands. I want to protect our water. And I want to make sure that we all have affordable health care. Everybody has access to health care, regardless of their medical conditions. We need more choice on innovation and education. And we need to emphasize some of these vocational technical schools that will turn around and provide jobs. They don't get degrees. They give skills and jobs. And that's what this community needs, is they need to be able to get to the VOTEC schools and be able to learn skills and jobs. Thank you. I'm out of time, and I appreciate your support and hope to represent you.
Thank you. Millie, you have a minute and a half.
Thank you. Well, it has been a true honor to serve you and to serve in the legislature for the past 6 years. In those 6 years, I've made connections, I've established relationships, I'm seen as a problem solver and a go-to person on really tough issues. The last 2 years in themselves, the tough issues that bubble up until the very last day of session have been education issues. I have been drawn into the Speaker's office to help solve these problems, whether my name ends up on the bill or not. I am working really hard to find real solutions and solve real problems, whether they're big problems like what do we do with the amount of standardized testing in our classrooms, or smaller problems like how do I work with CDOT to get something done here in Delta County. I'm your person. I know I have the relationships. I have the bipartisan skills. I'm respected at the Capitol. I have been just honored working with all of you. And I'm really torn with whether I should tell everyone how fabulous Delta County is, or should I keep it our secret. But no, truly, it is. I've met the most incredible people here, and it is the most beautiful part of Colorado. I'm so honored to be your representative, and I hope to have the opportunity to serve you for my last 2 years. Thank you.
Hold your applause for just a moment more, please, because I want to tell the people on the radio what we're doing. We're going to take, from the time I say go in a minute, we're going to take a 10-minute break because we have to switch around and get the county commissioner's candidates up. We have to get these guys off the stage, and that'll give you guys a chance to stretch. So whoever's the engineer on the other end, starting right now, we're going to take 10 minutes. Go. Now you can applaud.
Thank you.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you. Let me help you off the stage.
It'll take just a minute.